This is McGuire on the Wire, brought to you by McGuire Sponsel. We are a national consulting firm aiming to provide facts, advice, and updates on the ever-changing world of tax law. This podcast will give you base-level information as well as high-level thought leadership on how to navigate these technical disciplines. At McGuire Sponsel, we provide unique services to our clients using an old-school, hands-on approach that is deeply respected within the CPA industry. Now stick around and listen to one of our experts. We're glad you're here.
Today we want to talk about 1031 exchanges. Specifically, some of the changes to 1031 that occurred after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. Now, first, I think we need to understand what a 1031 exchange is, how they work, and then we can get into what changed. So, for those that don't know, a 1031 exchange is a way to defer gain on the sale of an asset. And I'm careful to say the sale of an asset because I'm going to separate out what we are talking about when it comes to pre-TCJA or Tax Cuts and Jobs Act and post-TCJA. So prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, 1031 exchanges were pretty liberal in what you were allowed to do. And in fact, you could do a 1031 exchange on aircraft or other types of personal property. And they were relatively common. The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, one of the big changes in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was to limit 1031 exchanges to real property. So let's talk about that a little bit, and then we'll get into why that's important today. So what does this mean? Well, in simple terms, and I'm not getting into the real math behind a 1031 exchange and everything else, but in simple terms, you're deferring gain on the sale of real estate, and you roll that gain into the next real estate transaction. So let's just take, for example, a taxpayer that has a piece of property that they acquired about 20 years ago. So let's just say it was done today in 2020, and so a piece of property that they acquired in 2000. And let's say they originally acquired that property for $10 million back in 2000. And when they acquired it, 20% of it was land, and 80% of it was considered real estate and depreciated over 39 years. So that means on the that property, they would have gotten about $4 million worth of depreciation. Assuming they've made no major improvements to it, that would put their basis in that property in 2020 at the time of sale at $6 million. Now they go and sell it, and real estate appreciates in value, so they go to sell it, and they have an offer to sell it for $13 million. Well, since their basis is only $6 million and they're selling it for $13 million, that would obviously create a gain of $7 million, creating a taxable event. What a 1031 exchange allows them to do is if they buy a property of equal or greater value, they can roll that gain over. So instead of paying tax on $7 million worth of gain, what they do is they go and buy a property worth $15 million. Use all the funds, that $13 million that rolls into the $15 million, plus they've got $2 million worth of additional basis, and they just roll it over. And then it continues depreciating, and they don't pay the gain at that point in time. Now, as I mentioned, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act fundamentally changed this, because prior to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, personal property could often be included in this 1031 exchange calculation, and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changed that and eliminated the ability to include personal property. And that led to a lot of discussion. And there was a discussion as to what personal property meant as it related to a 1031 exchange. And we've seen a lot of information back and forth. There's been some bad information, there's been some good information, and there's been a lot of debate as to what this means. Some people have said personal property definitions apply. Other people have said it's specifically related to movable personal property, but personal property that's integrated into the building wouldn't apply. And there's been a lot of back and forth. Other people have just said, just take the 1245 versus 1250 property definitions and go with it from there. And so there's been a lot of back and forth, and it really required that the IRS come out and give some guidance. And so they did that. On June 12th, 2020, the IRS came out with some proposed rules
as it related to 1031 exchanges. And the primary purpose of these proposed rules was to define this personal versus real property issue. And they don't even really get into personal property. They're really defining that real property. And what they said in this rulemaking is, number one, that this was needed. Because I believe their exact quote was, it was needed because taxpayers needed certainty regarding whether any part of the replacement property received in exchange is non-like-kind property subject to the gain recognition rules of Section 1031B. So it's a question of what constitutes real property. And they go in and they basically say that in this position, they do point out that it does not follow state guidelines. Following state guidelines would be, in a lot of ways, inappropriate for the federal government to do for multiple reasons, the first of which being that states don't agree. And so it's very hard for them to say, well, we're going to follow state guidelines if certain states don't agree with what personal property is. And so that would create all sorts of issues. Number one, make the federal government subject to the state government guidelines. But number two, you have an issue where states don't agree on it. So what happens if I sell a property in Indiana and buy a property in Ohio where the state guidelines for what constitute personal property don't necessarily follow? So that would create an issue in and of itself. And so they needed to define this. So first off, they went through and said, okay, real property needs to follow the real property guidelines from the old 1031 definition. And so they had to include buildings and improvements to land and other things. And then they also talked about other inherently permanent structures. So this could be parking garages, crops, other things like that. And it is important to note that there are some question marks still, and this is a proposed regulation, but there are some still question marks. But then we get into personal property. And it does specifically say, there was this question as to what personal property could be included. And so the IRS came in and said, okay, real property includes a building. Let's take gas lines to a building. And they said, any of the gas lines that are actually doing things to heat the building, those are included as real property. So a gas line going to your furnace to heat the building, that's real property. But then they said a gas line that provides fuel to a building's air fryers and ovens in a restaurant, that gas line is related to the equipment, so therefore it's personal property. It sounds very familiar to anyone who's been involved in a cost segregation study in the past. It basically follows the exact same guidelines. It's basically saying follow the guidelines, very similar to how we would look at a cost segregation study in the past. And that's important to know. It also states, and this is actually where then it gets interesting. It says that each distinct asset needs to be individually looked at. And says the proposed regulations provide that each distinct asset must be analyzed separately from any other assets to which the asset relates to determine if the asset is real property, whether land or structural component. Sounds very similar to me to the guidance that we saw as it related to the tangible property regulations, basically saying that each thing needs to be looked at separately. What that means is it gives us some flexibility. It gives us the ability to separate out assets. Now, I will say, just because a cost segregation study says something's personal property doesn't mean it is personal property for 1031 exchange purposes. I mentioned earlier that gas line. I will tell you, that's the majority of things, but it's not everything. And they give an example in the regs of a indoor sculpture. And they say company owns an office building and a large sculpture in the atrium of a building. The sculpture measures 30 feet tall by 18 feet wide and weighs 5 tons. The building was specifically designed to support the sculpture, which is permanently affixed to the building by its supports embedded in the building's foundation. The sculpture was constructed within the building. Removal would be costly and time-consuming and would destroy the sculpture. The sculpture is reasonably expected to remain in the building indefinitely. And they basically say that's a permanent fixture of the building and not personal property. It's a very, very, very specific example. And I would not expect that to hold true with most sculptures and buildings. That's just, it's showing that there can be some differences that might be constituted personal property because it is a decorative feature of the building, but it is inherently permanent to the building. So 99% of the time, we can follow those cost segregation or depreciation regulations, but there are some of these that fall outside of it. So what do we do now? Well, this fact that we need to analyze the building and each of its individual components separately, which it states in the regulations, and that follows the tangible property regulations, means that we can almost separate personal property and real property. Additionally, the regulations do give us some flexibility where we can have incidental personal property included that rolls over of up to 15%. So let's go back to my old example. My old example was taxpayer buys a building in 2000, depreciates it. That creates a depreciated basis of $6 million, and they sell it for $13 million and roll that into a new building. Now, if that new building was purchased for $16 million, so they had $13 million worth of sale price and the proceeds, and they roll that into a $16 million building, in theory, they could do a cost segregation study on that new building that they acquired, determine 20% of it, or approximately $3 million, is personal property, not eligible for the 1031 exchange. Let's just assume it's exactly $3 million. That means they've got a $3 million worth of real property, or sorry, $13 million worth of real property, and $3 million worth of personal property. So they can roll their old building that they sold for $13 million into that $13 million worth of real property and separate out the $3 million worth of personal property without creating a boot or gain on the sale. Now, that's that example. Now, let's not take that original example. Let's take a property that I acquired 2 years ago for $10 million, and I did a cost segregation study on it. And the cost segregation study on that $10 million property found that $1 million of it was land improvements. Keep in mind, land improvements are eligible for 1031 treatment. They're considered real property under these regulations. And $1 million worth of personal property. The $1 million can't be is not considered real property, but $1 million worth of personal property is under 15% of the basis. Remember, I said earlier that the regs do allow us to have incidental personal property of up to 15%. So in this case, I hold my $10 million building. I've taken $2 million worth of depreciation on it, and I go and sell it. And I sell that $10 million building for $12 million. So I took $2 million worth of depreciation. I sell it for $12 million. So I have a potential gain of $4 million. I roll that into a $16 million building. I don't need to worry about my $2 million worth of depreciation I took because my personal property is less than the 15% incidental amount. And the land improvements are considered real property. So really everything I have is real property except for this 10% personal, which is considered incidental. I roll that, like I said, I sold it for $13 million. I roll it into a $16 million building. I can actually go in and then do a cost seg study on the new building as long as the personal property I find is less than the delta between the sale price and the purchase price of the new one. I'm not creating boot in that transaction. So there is some flexibility here, but it is important to understand these regulations. Now, I will point out these regulations very, very closely follow the guidance that we've been giving to our clients all along. It is something that we've been very careful to make sure we follow guidance that's out there and try to follow along with where we thought the IRS was going to come down. So we appreciate the fact that the IRS has really backed up that position. Now, I should also point out these are proposed regulations, and there are some areas where they are requesting comments and looking for a comment period. So they could change before they go to final. However, it does give us that guidance and that comfort level to see that the IRS is really going after this in a way that we've expected. So with that, I appreciate everyone logging on today. If you have any more questions about this or anything else related to these types of issues, please feel free to reach out to your McGuire Sponsor representative. Thank you for listening.
Thanks so much for listening to McGuire on the Wire. Have a question from today's episode or interested in our team covering another topic? Reach out to us at McGuire on the Wire at McGuireSponsel.com.